From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
In the words of the late, great Karl Lagerfeld, whose one of his last tweets was, "Believe it or not, I like rap."
Do you think this latte levy will mean that people will think twice about buying a coffee from you?
Oh, absolutely. And coffee shops, they're will lose customers over it.
Well, the NRA is a perfectly acceptable organisation to a lot of people. And I'd love to know what Don McLean's crime is.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, Ireland and the Platy Jubes. A match made in heaven? Don McLean and the NRA. A match made in hell? And celebrating Pride Month in Donegal. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's not listening now. Perhaps it never will. The increasingly inaccurately titled Ryan Tuberty Show hasn't had its eponymous host in the chair very often in recent times, but happily the musings on the news, the newsings, if you will, remain an integral part of so many people's morning listening. And this morning, Brendan Courtney was the man doing the musing.
I don't know if you saw this in the paper this morning. One couple took full advantage of the Bloom Disney-themed Beauty and the Beast garden yesterday. Very cute. Connor Curley from Dundalk got down on one knee and proposed to Nicola McNamee because he knew she adored Beauty and the Beast, and off they went into the sunset, happily engaged to drink champagne. But it made me think about another Disney-inspired proposal that didn't go according to plan. Anyone who's ever planned a proposal, have you ever done that? And you know, I've never done it actually because I couldn't be bothered, because it takes too much work and too much effort goes into planning a proposal. So imagine planning a proposal in Disneyland Paris. Well, in a 21-second video clip, it shows a viral clip that went viral on over the weekend. I just couldn't stop watching it and I feel guilty. It shows a young man on bended knee holding a ring box aloft and he's just about to propose to his girlfriend who's standing with the Disney palace in the background. It's absolutely the perfect scene if you're a Disney fan. When a Disney employee wearing Mickey Mouse ears and everything rushes between them and grabs the engagement box out of his hand to stop the man proposing. And in it, you can see the young man mouthing the words, "But she said yes," to which the Disneyland worker replies, "Yeah, that's great, but over here will be better." Total job's worth, ruined their day. Now, apparently Disneyland Paris did apologise and he hadn't paid for the photograph or whatever. But ooh, all the effort that goes into that and what a waste of time. I have to say, on Sunday now, I was feeling a little aggrieved with the weather. And we shouldn't moan because we do live in Ireland and we are used to it. But I met a woman in a coffee queue, as you do, who was on her holidays over here on the East Coast. She was from Galway. And apparently she told me the sun was splitting the rocks in Galway. Is that true on Sunday? Was it roasting in Galway? And then I felt really bad when I read, letting you hear this, the poor 180 passengers on a flight home from Corfu to Dublin on Saturday night. And for a couple of reasons, the plane was rerouted to Nuremberg and the passengers, 180 of them, had to spend the night in the airport on camp beds. You'd be absolutely raging. You'd be beside yourself. So I thought, spare a thought, and I felt guilty for moaning about the rain.
That was an awful trial those poor people had at Nuremberg, wasn't it? Yeah, suit yourselves. But spare a thought for the young people who'll be sitting in big rooms tomorrow.
Nearly 60,000. In fact, a very recent Google a couple of minutes ago informs me that it's actually 58,614 students will commence the Leaving Cert tomorrow. Oh, God love them. What are your memories of your Leaving Cert week? I was only 16 when I did my Leaving Cert. My memories are pretty stoic. Unbelievably, and I'm not so religious anymore, but I got Mass every morning of my exams. I suppose it was kind of a last-ditch attempt to bring a higher power into the equation. And I remember my mother standing in the kitchen and seeing me go out at 7 a.m. in the morning. And about day four, she said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Going to Mass." She said, "Okay, fair enough." And myself and the primary school cleaners from across the road formed quite the little breakfast club, I have to say. And then, of course, with some serious cramming that week, I did okay in my exams, I have to say. And in fact, just to also mention, at the fully ripened age of 48 in 2020, I graduated with an honours master's in March. And I got into doing that without having a level 8. I did a thing called ORPEL, which is recognition of prior learning. So there are many routes to your goals. So I hope that helps to ease the pressure in some way.
Helping the kids and getting in a decent little humble brag as well. He's good, this Courtney lad. But he's not one for stretching out the newsings, that's for sure, because that's it. Brevity is there and all that. Now, parents could see monthly childcare costs cut by hundreds of euro under plans being considered by the government. Elaine Loughlin, deputy political editor of the Irish Examiner, spoke about the plans to Clare Byrne this morning.
Well, it does seem that the government is working, and the Children's Minister, Roderick O'Gorman, specifically, is working on this substantial package to help parents with the cost of childcare. And we do know that parents are paying substantial amounts to have their children cared for while they work each month. I think the average cost now is around 800 euro, but obviously that can vary significantly depending on what part of the country you're in and also what type of care you're getting. Because if you have a child under the age of one, the costs increase. And we do know also in urban areas, the likes of Dublin, you could be charged up to 1,200 euro a month. Mm-hmm. So it's a massive burden on parents right now, and it's one that the government is eager to tackle in the budget.
So what we're talking about here, and this is why this is different to what we've seen before, which is a freeze in fees, this would be a cut. This would be a reduction for parents, would it?
Yes, well, that's essentially what the Children's Minister is saying, that there will be a significant cut as part of the measures that he hopes to bring in as part of the budget in October. Parents are given already a subsidy under the National Childcare Scheme. And what Roderick O'Gorman had said is that that subsidy essentially had been eked away over the years because creche fees went up. So essentially, the subsidy meant nothing because parents continuously saw the price of childcare increase as the fees went up. So last year, the government announced that there would be additional core funding for the sector on the basis that childcare providers froze the fees. So on top of this now, he hopes to add additional funding to that National Childcare Scheme. So it would mean an effective decrease in fees. And it is hoped that that decrease would be substantial. Hundreds of euro you're talking a month if these proposals go through. Mm-hmm. Now, Claire, there is a long way between now and budget day and a lot of toing and froing between government departments, and anything that is brought forward for budget day will have to go through the Department of Public Expenditure. But we do know that childcare is a key priority, not just for the Children's Minister, but for the three parties in government now.
Okay, and so if it meets obstacles, it's likely that they will be worked through, given that there seems to be a willingness across the board to do something on this front. Maybe not the substantial cut that the Green Minister is talking about, but there may be a compromise position.
Exactly, but we do know as well that Fine Gael have come out strongly in recent weeks on this issue. Leo Varadkar stressing the need to help parents out with what effectively can be a second mortgage in some instances for parents. And perhaps he is looking to his own traditional base, those working families who would be perhaps middle class, middle earners, and they are now struggling with the cost of childcare. So it might be something that also Fine Gael is pushing as well. So I think the Green Minister may have help on that front when he does go to Michael McGrath with his asks for a significant increase in the budget for childcare.
And tell me, this cut, we're talking about hundreds of euro a month. I mean, parents listening to this will just be crossing everything, hoping that it's true and that it happens. But will it be means tested, or will everyone save?
That is a good question, Claire, because under the child care scheme, the National Child Care Scheme at the moment, there are two different subsidies that are given out. The first one is the universal subsidy, and the second one is obviously the means tested. It's to help lower income parents with the cost of childcare. So you would imagine that it'd be a mix of both. The details do have to be worked out, and even the introduction of this has to be worked out, because whether it's introduced from January of next year or perhaps it may come later in the year, so it's not as big of a strain on the national purse, mm-hmm. if you were to defer it, let's say, till August or September.
The timing is everything, and you know there are wider cost of living measures that government is considering, and we've heard repeatedly from government figures that their focus is on the next budget. These measures, though, could they be seen any earlier? Are they under pressure to do more quicker?
Yeah, well, certainly the government is under pressure to bring about not just measures around childcare, but the cost of living in general. We do see inflation continuing to spiral. And just last week, Sinn Féin brought about proposals to give lower and middle income workers up to €200 of a handout, I suppose, to help with the cost of living. Now, that was dismissed by government, and ministers are saying that they are now holding on till the budget to unveil a large cost of living package. And as well, when you hear the Taoiseach an Tánaiste defending what the government has done so far, they will mention the other measures, the subsidy to the energy bill that we had earlier on in the year, and other measures that have already been introduced. And they say that you can't be maybe drip feeding €100 here and there every month, that it's better to come forward with a large package at budget time. And that would cover everything from healthcare to transport to childcare.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Elaine, is the nighttime economy. These proposals from Catherine Martin's department, which we're likely to hear about today. What's coming? What will this involve?
There will be some pilot events. Basically, it seems to be most Thursdays is what the day of the week that's been picked out, that the likes of the National Concert Hall, the National Museum, IMA in Dublin, and the Crawford Gallery in Cork will open late. So those wanting to get access to various things that are happening there will be able to go after work late in the evening. And it's to encourage this nighttime economy. There will also be 6 advisors appointed across 6 towns and cities. Nighttime advisors is what they're calling them. And that would be to develop a nighttime economy, basically to get people out and about and enjoying cultural events after 6 p.m. Because we do know that we are a country where a lot of things, unfortunately, do shut at 5 or 6 p.m. And it's very difficult, bar perhaps going to the pub, to socialise and meet people late into the evening. Okay.
Elaine Loughlin, Deputy Political Editor of the Irish Examiner, talking to Clare Byrne this morning about government plans to cut childcare costs for families, as well as plans to encourage what they're calling the nighttime economy. Donegal had its first Pride March as part of Pride Month, and one of the organisers, Jen McCarron, spoke to Ray Darcy this afternoon.
Oh, Ray, it was absolutely amazing. It was there was an electric atmosphere. It was just an incredibly colourful, carnival-like event, and so inclusive of all families and children, all ages, different community groups. The allies were just lining the streets. There were thousands there that I could see. It was just amazing. It was everything we hoped for.
Brilliant. Because you were fearful that you wouldn't get enough people to hold the flag. How many people did you need?
I myself wasn't particularly fearful.
Okay, right.
I think I was quietly confident that we would. But the flag that we borrowed from our fabulous neighbours at Foyle Pride in Derry, it takes 100 people to carry that flag alone. And there was 100 people or more ready to carry it, along with walkers left over and the additional groups that were just walking as part of the parade, and all their lovely, colourful outfits and costumes and effort that people put in to come out on Sunday was absolutely amazing.
And Jen, are you born and bred Buncrana?
I was raised here through all my school years, and so I'm very much part of the community here. This is my home.
Apart from an influx during the summer, it's a small enough town.
Yeah, it's a relatively small town. We're kind of, I guess it's one of the most northerly points of Ireland. Mm. So this is now the most northerly Pride parade to take place in the country. But people came from all over to come to it, Ray. It was people from West Donegal, people from the north of Ireland, people from Dublin, Galway, Clare. People travelled home from London, from America, as well as the crowds that were there in the day. It's the messages that we were getting in advance, and even now people are still buzzing.
Great.
We're just getting some amazing messages through about it being unforgettable, and a lot of people with tears in their eye on the day coming up going, just thank you for making this happen. They were so moved, and of course we're moved because of the messages we're getting too.
Yes. And you must have been moved yourself, because I would imagine growing up gay in Buncrana, you never thought that that you'd see the day that there was a Pride parade going down the main street.
Yeah, Ray, I won't lie. I have 20 years ago had tears dripping my face talking to friends about the idea of a Pride Parade in Buncrana. But last year, when the businesses in the town and different community centres in the town put up rainbow flags, we just thought, you know what, the time is right and the town is ready, and we need the visibility. We need this for our young people. We need this for the generations to come. We need to create visibility. It's very much needed. We're so grateful to the volunteers that came out, the county council support, the Red Cross, the community groups, the theatre groups, the Anishon Carnival for lending us costumes, dance groups, sports groups. Everybody came on board, and it was just incredible, the support.
Do you mind me asking what age are you? Do you mind me asking that question?
I'm in my early 40s.
Right. Okay. Yeah. No. Because I just want to know where you were at certain stages in our history as a country and our attitudes.
So I came out in the 90s.
Right.
And at that time in my life in Donegal, I did not know one other person who was gay. I just did not know anyone that was gay. So we're still. Like, the young people and families that have approached me in the last year or two are still in that kind of worried phase of what will aunties think, what will cousins think, and it was such a beautiful message on Sunday, because the community really came out in such massive numbers that it was like, visibly, we are welcoming everybody in this community and everybody will be celebrated, everybody's valued. It was so incredibly moving to see that numbers lining the streets, and not only the main street, there wasn't enough room for everybody. We were hearing that's why the back streets were also lined as we walked to the main street. We didn't expect to see people there. Just all generations, right? It was something pretty outstandingly spectacular.
Well done to you. It was you and how many other people organised it?
There is five of us. We're a very, very small group.
Yeah.
Some of us are LGBT+, some of us are allies. I suppose we reflect the diversity that is in the community and has always been there. It's just been less visible. And I know that on the day we did send a thank you as well to past generations who were brave enough to be themselves at a time when it was a less accepting country.
Yeah.
Because really, that day, the Pride Parade wouldn't have been possible if it wasn't for their bravery and support and courage all those years ago when it was much harder. So, we've had a lot of messages from the older generation as well, which are really moving.
Great.
Ray Darcy talking to Jen McCarran, one of the organisers of Donegal's first ever Pride March this afternoon. Brendan Courtney, like Karl Lagerfeld, likes rap. At least, that's what he told Dublin rapper Malachy this morning.
Is your summer shaping up? What's coming up?
It's looking really good for a change. You know, I think for artists, it's great to see the floodgates have opened. You know, there's plans in place, there's festivals, there's shows on. It's back to normal in a certain sense. But for myself, I have about 8 festivals lined up. I've Body and Soul coming up as well from the 17th the 19th of July. That's in Westmead, I believe. I'm really busy, and I'm really fortunate to be so busy this summer. Now, mind you, I'm still working. I'm going to work after the show just to get me out of bed. But on the weekends, I'll be doing festivals as much as possible.
Where are you working?
I'm working in Blackrock Clinic as like a porter, as a helper, I suppose.
Amazing. So you're playing massive stage of festivals and then back down to earth as a porter.
Yeah, you know, because, I mean, it's great to do the shows, and I'm very grateful to do what I do, but at the same time, I think from a human point of view, I really enjoy being around people and socialising, and I kind of, it keeps me in check, and as my mum says, it gets me out of bed in the morning.
Yeah. Do you get any material from interacting with people in the hospital?
I've heard this a bit. You know, I think it's best to stay professional in a sense, but and not take on so many people's journeys, and especially because it's not the nicest of places a lot of the times.
Okay.
But a lot of the people I meet, I do feel inspired by, and purely because their optimism, you know, coming into a hospital can be quite a sad and a scary place. But, you know, the people I meet, they improve my day and I improve theirs, because their optimism coming in to visit a patient or a friend or a family member, whatever it may be, seeing their smile in the face, it gives myself and the staff in there a little bit of a boost. So it's great.
You're quite the dude. So go back a phase.
Yeah.
People will remember you possibly from your Late Late Show appearance in 2020, which was really moving. Mm-hmm. And it was to talk about the RTÉ Player documentary series, I'm Fine, which was a documentary series you took part in about young men, particularly mental health. You told a story on the Late Late Show about your history with your own mental mm-hmm. health. Will you remind listeners what that story was?
Yeah, of course. So it was 2019. I was 19 years old and I was going through an accumulation of things at the time. I had problems with my head and my family and my friends and I'd just coming out of school about a year. And I think I just lost my routine. And with that, I kind of got sucked into nightlife and lost my head a bit. And over time, I just reached the climax, which was New Year's Eve of 2019. And, you know, it didn't seem like a lot of the time, but when it builds up in your mind, you kind of feel quite isolated. So I really didn't feel like I had anyone. So I had a breakdown on the New Year's Eve of 2019. Fortunately, I had four great friends by my side to come and help me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm forever grateful for them. They'll always be remembered in my life. No matter what happens. And then, you know, shortly came after my family because I just kind of had to tell them what happened. And because I kept it to myself, Brendan, that was the problem.
Okay.
I opened up them then and then eventually led me to being more comfortable with the state I'm in and being able to heal in a sense.
So if you're comfortable, can you describe what the breakdown felt like? If people can relate to it, what was
of
it like?
Of course. For me, it was quite intense in the sense I really had no idea where I was or what I was doing. So I was erratic. My behavior was very unnatural. I was kind of like violently crying. It was an intense moment for a 19-year-old boy, you know, walking the streets. But you know, you have to be honest because if people see the signs of this, Brendan, like people have to know the signs of it and what to do. So it was intense. It was overwhelming. And I actually can't recall a lot of what happened. And I think a part of my brain maybe wanted me to forget that trauma and move on. But, you know, going to therapy, getting the medicine and, you know, speaking to family members and friends is really what made me, you know, it's not something that ever is completely healed. But at least I know the triggers, I know the signs and I can be a better person to myself.
And do you feel, I mean, you're relatively young.
Yeah, 22.
22. You're so worldly and experienced about it now. Do you feel a responsibility to talk about it now in some ways?
You know, I think with music, I speak about it a lot. And I try to speak about it as Hugh as well, as myself. But, you know, at the end of the day, I am human and that I do make mistakes. And I can't always be this perfect person. And I can't always be like, I never consider myself this light for mental health or like holding this responsibility to spread it on others. I can't do that. But what I can do is share my experience with people.
Yeah.
And hopefully that will give people a little bit of solace and realise that young men and women, no matter the age, the colour, the race, the gender, whatever it may be, can experience this and get through it. You know, I have a hard time sometimes. We all do. But we get through it.
Do you think more people would benefit from therapy, from counselling?
Yeah, I do. But I really think, you know, I have a lot of friends that, like, fortunately enough, I can afford the private therapy at the moment.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of friends of mine that can't. And I think the government need to be putting in better solutions for that because the waiting list for some of these is horrendous. And unfortunately, we need to treat therapy like an emergency department where it needs to be seen right away. It's not something that we get put down on a list and we wait 6 or 9 months. That's ludicrous to me. You know, when I went into therapy, I needed it. So I think the government need to be putting quicker solutions to some of these people that are either seeking medicine or therapy. Because for me, I was fortunate enough my family could afford the private therapy. There's a lot of people in this country that can't.
And do you think it's more difficult for younger men to talk about their feelings than it is for women? There's just a gender difference there, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I do believe it is. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that we both struggle equally or more, whatever it may be. But I think men have a harder time opening up. And it's probably just deeply rooted in that young mentality and that traditional way of, you know, hold it in, be a man, whatever that cliche may be. And fortunately enough, we're kind of moving beyond that now. And those traditional ways are dying out in the best way of it because, You know, I've been able to speak to my father, who would be on the older side of things, and it's great to actually sit down with him, have a chat, have a cry, whatever it may be. And it's really important because we're so locked in our ways. You know, I think the greatest thing for me was sitting down and having a chat with my brother or my father about these things, to know that they struggle too, or a family member, whatever it may be. Yeah.
So you have a busy summer coming up.
Yeah.
And it's festivals.
It's festivals,
you know,
yes.
How are you going to look after yourself?
I'm staying off the drink.
Yeah. Congratulations. I don't know if congratulations is the right phrase there, but yeah.
No, I think because as an artist, it can, there's a lot. I have a lot going on. You know, I have like 8 festivals lined up. I'm just gonna drive to every festival. I'm gonna treat it like a job this summer rather than, you know, going. Obviously, the festivities and the music and the culture is amazing, but I'm gonna go. I'm gonna see the acts I want to do, or I'm just gonna see the acts I want to see. I'm gonna do my show, and I'm gonna go home.
The eminently sensible Malachy, talking to Brendan Courtney on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. The Platy Jubes, I'm sorry, was covered worldwide, including, of course, in this country. And Ireland's complicated relationship with British royalty was put under the microscope of history by Diarmaid Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD, on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne.
I remember reading the book by Mary Kenny, Crown and Shamrock, which is a very good overview of this theme. And she's describing a 9-year-old in Sandymount in 1953, the summer of 1953. And she was staying with her aunt and uncle. And they were getting all dolled up to go out to this soiree in the local Methodist hall. And there was a lot of secrecy about it. But it turned out they were going to look at the film of the Queen's coronation. And when she found out about it, Mary was told that she had to keep quiet about it. It was kind of a clandestine, secret, guilty pleasure. And there had been plans to show the film in cinemas in Dublin, but the Anti-Partition League at the time, which was actively campaigning, threatened that they would disrupt these showings. So they were cancelled.
It's interesting that, because if you go back then to 1911, to Queen Victoria's visit, different, completely different ballgame.
Well, that was King George the Fifth. Queen Victoria, before him, had come 4 times. You know, royal visits were always a big deal.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. I mean, the Queen first came in the August of 1849. Now, consider what had happened in Ireland the previous couple of years.
Well, she was the famine visitor.
She was the famine visitor. And, I mean, she blew hot and cold about everything,
yes,
including the Irish. You know, she was very volatile. But there's a banner in 1849, Hail Victoria, Ireland's hope, England's glory.
See, that's what I don't understand. Because Ireland in famine times... And there was clearly a knowledge that there was food in the country and it was being sent elsewhere. So why welcome Queen Victoria?
Because Ireland is so firmly stitched into the fabric of the British Empire, you know, and the 19th century. Consider something like the British Army, for example, the amount of Irish men who were serving in the Crown Forces. 1/5 of all British Army officers in 1878 were Irish. You know, after the Napoleonic War, over 40% of the regular British soldiers were Irish. So, you know, the Irish are serving the Empire in a variety of different ways. That doesn't mean they're ardent royalists, but it means Ireland is very much a part of the family. And they often referred to it as the family. But there's also a sense on the part of British royals that Ireland is a place apart, that they don't understand the Irish, that they sometimes can make very disparaging remarks about not just their wildness, their backwardness, but also their irrational faith. Queen Victoria shared her husband Albert's view, for example, that the Irish could be coaxed out of their irrational Catholic faith. And yet she could sometimes record very warm things about the Irish and their looks and, you know, the affection that she held for them. So you get these contrasting assertions all the time. When George V came in 1911, that was the last time a reigning monarch visited Southern Ireland before the current Queen. So there was exactly 100 years between them. And again, he recorded coming in to Kingstown, Dunleary, that there was this joy and affection and warmth for him. And he recorded that with a degree of self-satisfaction. And then he set it as his political mission to prevent civil strife in Ireland when it came to the Home Rule crisis and everything that flowed from that. But of course, at that stage, monarchs were not directly wielding political power. They could do things behind the scenes. And obviously he opened the Northern Ireland Parliament in 1921 and made an appeal for peace, which was quite influential at the time. So they certainly could have an influence.
But there was change afoot in 1911, because the welcome that he got wasn't comparable to the welcome Queen Victoria.
Well, you see, this was always the thing. I mean, you would get more protests, obviously, in the early 20th century. And even with Queen Victoria's last visit in 1900s, there were protest committees. There was organised Republican opposition. Mm-hmm. Now, it was still small scale compared to the bigger welcome. And the same was true in 1911. But it is growing. There's no doubt about that. And you get this interesting question. Do we distinguish between the Crown as an institution and the individuals who populate that institution? And the Crown as an institution is becoming more problematic because of the difficulties in Anglo-Irish relations. And of course, that is something that becomes very emotive, particularly as republicanism gains in strength. And like, if you take the great controversies of 100 years ago, the symbolism of the Crown having an ongoing role in Irish affairs, the oath of fidelity or the oath of allegiance to the Crown as part of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, that's hugely difficult for an awful lot of Republicans who oppose the treaty. And even for those who accept the treaty and pragmatically accept the treaty, they can understand how that will obviously stick in their throat. You know, how can you claim to be independent if the Crown has an ongoing role? And it is largely symbolic in theory, but in practice, it is something that they have to sign up to.
But just you have to say it, don't you?
And I mean, this caused difficulties then, obviously. Like, we have a Governor General as a result of the treaty, the Crown's representative in Ireland. What does that mean by the 1920s? You know, Ireland is still part of the Commonwealth, obviously. And this controversy, sometimes farce, over whether or not, if the Governor General, for example, visits Trinity College, should God Save the Queen be played, or God Save the King be played, or should it be the Soldier's Song? And then when Fianna Fáil come to power in the 1930s, they're actively snubbing the office of Governor General and the person of Governor General to try and undermine it. And what they do then is they take advantage of the abdication crisis in 1936.
Yeah, this is fascinating.
It's fascinating because, you know, it's such a sensational news story internationally.
Scandal.
It's a scandal, and it's not quite covered to the same degree in Ireland. And the Benedictine friar, Mark Hellerman, wrote amusingly about this in 1999. He described his mother in 1936, who's lapping up as much information as she can get about the abdication crisis. And, you know, she's talking to people in Dublin about it. But she was a very conscientious Catholic. And she asked a Jesuit if it was libel or scandalous to be talking about this divorce crisis and this abdication crisis. And the response of the Jesuit was, I'm not really sure, but it's really interesting. Tell me more. You know, what information do you have on it? But De Valera saw an opportunity there to move quickly to remove any references to the Crown from the Irish constitution. And of course, he's on his way to a new constitution that will declare Ireland a republic in all but name. And there's only one really last remaining link with the royals, and that was the External Relations Act, because Ireland is still in the Commonwealth until 1949, and the Crown still, the monarch still has to sign the credentials of ambassadors who are representing that Commonwealth, Irish ambassadors abroad. Mm-hmm. And that was really difficult as well for people like Sean McBride, who became Minister for External Affairs in the late 1940s. He's a former Chief of Staff of the IRA. And when he's on diplomatic visits to London and he's having dinners and so on, he has to toast the health of the King. And, you know, that's very difficult for that generation of Republicans. So with the Declaration of the Republic, there is obviously the severing of that last link. And I mean, Mary Kenny went to the archives of Windsor, and, you know, you'll find pockets of Southern loyalists and loyalism in Ireland, and they're writing over expressing their dismay at the severing of this link. And the way the King at the time put it, George VI, why would they leave the family? Isn't that a very interesting question, that they use that description, the family, even though they often see Ireland as a place apart, the idea that they are part of the family,
yes,
of Commonwealth nations, and that this is a matter of regret. And he goes out of his way to congratulate the Irish President, Sean T. O'Kelly, on Ireland becoming a republic. But he also thanks all of those who served in the British Crown Forces, including the estimated 60 or 70,000 that fought, the 200,000 that fought during the First World War. So, I mean, they are nodding to those traditions and what they see as those loyalties.
Dermot Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History in UCD, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the Irish people's complicated relationship with British royalty in the days before Hello Magazine and Royal Watchers on Instagram. Singer Don McLean pulled out of a performance at a National Rifle Association conference following the mass shooting at Uvalde in Texas. He's playing a show in Ireland in October, and on this afternoon's Live Line, Joe Duffy wondered if people should think less about the day the music died and more about the day the children died. The first caller in to bat for the gun-promoting singer was Ciarán Jones.
Well, the NRA is a perfectly acceptable organisation to a lot of people. And I'd love to know what Don McLean's crime is. He's a member of an organisation that's perfectly legal, perfectly acceptable to a lot of people. They have been around for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. So why did he pull out at our conference?
Well, same reason why a lot of people are forced to. I don't think he pulled out. He was
well. There wasn't any other conference that weekend that people pulled out of.
Well, do you follow me? The whole thing was cancelled because there was
it wasn't cancelled.
All the artists that were due to play, Joe, were pulled out.
But I have a list of artists who did perform. Maybe I wasn't there. I don't know if they did or not. But apparently a number. But why? You're saying it's a perfectly legal organisation, which it is, perfectly acceptable, which is debatable to a lot of people. So if that's the case, why did Don McLean pull out?
Because he was probably pressurised to pull out.
So he didn't do it out of the goodness of his own heart, saying, are we mad selling submachine guns to 18-year-olds on their 18th birthday?
That's not our issue, Joe. That's America's issue. We have similar, as you said earlier, we have a lot of legally held guns here in this country.
Too many, a quarter of a million. One in every eight households in Ireland has a gun.
Look, if people are going to protest outside Don McLean, you know, let's go and protest outside Daniel O'Donnell's concert because he's promoting the lottery gambling. Disgraceful, you know.
Well, hang on. You cannot stop this nonsense. You can't kill somebody with a lottery ticket. You can kill 19 children. Go back with a submachine gun.
Where were these protests before the tragedy happened? NRA convention. Why wasn't that cancelled?
Apparently there are protests, but the NRA conference was not cancelled.
Okay,
it went ahead. But I'm saying maybe people feel in this country they feel absolutely powerless about the states. But we live in a social world. There's great interaction among people, mm-hmm. and people think that there should be that the American Senate or the American people should come to their senses on guns. By the way, the opinion polls show that American people are much more sensible about gun restrictions than the Senate is because there's a lot
of people within the NRA, Joe, that are in favour of stricter controls. Well, that doesn't get mentioned, is it?
Well, it's not their policy.
Well, overall it isn't, but they're in favour of more stricter controls.
Hmm. So if there was a protest, Kieran, you'd protest.
Now, look, Joe, I defend anybody's right to protest, absolutely. But, you know, if we're going to is a man not entitled to make a living, perform in Dublin for his fans?
I think he's made a good living now. 50,
yeah, of course he has.
50 years. Since American Boy.
Yeah, and he's entitled to keep making a living, surely. The answer will be how many tickets are being sold. And I'll tell you now that the concert won't be cancelled.
Guns are the leading cause of death of US children.
Nothing to do with Don McLean, Joe.
Well, it's to do with the whole gun culture, surely.
Yes, it is, absolutely, which Don McLean might be part of. But, you know, he hasn't committed any crime. I have a few guns in my cupboard, so can't cancel my whole tour and you know, don't let me perform for the fans.
No, it's the support of the NRA.
Well,
that would be the
issue. There's a lot of bands in Ireland, Joe, who perform in promotion of lots of organisations. Some of them illegal, but you know, nothing.
Like what?
Well, look, Joe, I don't want to go into people promoting paramilitary organisations, but we all know the bands that do.
Where's the
protests?
That's news to me. McLean pulled out, but musicians like you tell me if you know any of these, Lee Greenwood, Larry Gatlin, Restless Heart lead singer Larry Stewart and Danielle Peck performed.
I saw the list, Joe, and the only other one I'm familiar with is Lee Greenwood. But,
there have been 212 mass shootings. I presume that means more than one person killed in an incident.
I would imagine so,
In the last 145 days.
Yeah, it's terrible,
it's
Joe.
It's lunacy.
Absolutely, it is. And I'm not supporting the NRA in any shape or form. But it's a separate issue to Don McLean performing for his fans in Dublin.
So you think as someone's personal opinions, personal life...
Absolutely.
...should nothing...
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
Nothing.
No, not at all. If somebody who I admired had a string of serious offences of whatever nature wouldn't stop me going to listen to their music.
And then somebody's texts in saying he has a conviction for domestic violence.
Yeah, a minor conviction, but...
minor or major, still a conviction.
Absolutely, it's a conviction, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Well, we're going to be here all day, Joe, if we list all the celebrity singers who've got criminal convictions. Johnny Cash was in prison. Chuck Berry was in prison.
What was Johnny Cash in prison for?
I think it was a road traffic thing, to be honest. But Chuck Berry was in prison for, we won't go into that one, but, you know, he played in Dublin not long before he died.
Don McLean, age 70, was arrested at his home in Camden for domestic violence against his wife, Patricia Spelling, who told investigators the musician had a violent temper for decades. You said in the January statement that McLean terrorised her over hours the night of his arrest. For the first 10 years or so, his rage was unfathomably deep and very scary. And he pleaded guilty. Now, in fairness, I will read out the whole thing because it's he, which is your point. He pleaded guilty to misdemeanor counts of domestic violence assault, domestic violence, criminal threatening, criminal mischief, and criminal restraint stemming from a mid-January incident. That's what his attorney told the media. He accepted a plea of guilty. And then they're now estranged.
Yeah, well, no surprise there. But Don McLean, was he on the Late Show not that long ago?
Okay, good point, yeah.
Where were the protests? You know, something comes out. If this crime predates his last appearance on the Late Show, which I could be wrong, but I do believe he was on... Irish television now, somewhere.
Just to be fair, I don't want Daniel O'Donnell suing me, but like, when you cannot compare Don McLean and Daniel O'Donnell because Don McLean...
I'm making the point, Joe, that Daniel O'Donnell has promoted the lottery.
Has he? Now, but that's not illegal and you can't kill someone with a lottery
ticket.
Neither
has being a member of the NRA be illegal. But look at the misery gambling has caused in this country.
Okay. Mark Kelly is in Chicago. Mark, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon, Joe.
How are you? Do you have your point, please.
I was just talking to the girl. So being a member of the NRA isn't illegal. So
yeah,
all this thing of trying to cancel, you know what I mean, Don McLean. What's the purpose of that? And why does he need to be cancelled? He's entitled to accept any gig that he gets. You know, that's the way he makes his living. So what has he done wrong? And why do you try to vilify, you know, organizations? There's lots of people in the States here that own guns. They're all good gun owners. And it's a part of their life. It's a part of everyday life here. So
it's a part of everyday death.
Right. You know, listen, there's lots of things that are part of death. You know what I mean?
An alcoholic, yeah. You'll kill yourself. If you get into a car, you might kill others. But with a submachine gun or whatever they call them, AR-15s or whatever that lunatic had, he went into the school and 21 people, including 10-year-olds, were dead within 20 minutes. Hello?
You're right. And everybody is horrified with that. Yeah. You know, everybody is horrified with that. Well, unless you have a really open and inclusive debate about all of this, you are not going to solve any of this stuff.
I have to say, I did not see the Irish pro-NRA lobby being to the fore in this debate. But that's Irishman Mark, who lives in Chicago, talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Live Line about guns, mass shootings and the NRA and Don McLean. As we've already heard Brendan Courtney mention on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show, the dreaded Leaving Cert starts tomorrow for tens of thousands of pupils. But if you're worried about how you'll get on, whether or not you'll get the points you want, don't let it consume your life for the next month. Brendan spoke to Dr. Sinead Loughran about how she didn't let an average academic performance in the Leaving Cert stop her from doing medicine.
I sat my Leaving Cert in 2009.
Okay, so
a while back.
Describe what kind of a student you were. Let's paint the picture.
I was generally just an average student. I enjoyed school. I played loads of sports. I just was average. I was never achieving outrageous kind of scores or anything like that. So I was just kind of tipping along.
Grand. And did you do any of those career aptitude tests they do in fourth year, you know, to help determine what kind of career path might suit you?
Yeah, I did. I remember one coming back because I loved maths.
Right.
Thinking that maybe engineering would be good. But I always said to them, no, like, I had a passion for medicine. I did want to do it. But I remember them kind of saying at the time, you know, well, if you look at your scores, I don't think that's going to be a career path for you, because naturally to get medicine, and even this day and age, you have to be scoring, you know, the top marks, getting maximum points, if not achieving more than the maximum points. So kind of shot down nearly.
Yeah. So it was that direct, was it?
Fairly, yeah.
Wow, it sounds almost outdated even now, doesn't it? Because, you know, you can shoot for your dreams. Okay, so you ruled out medicine.
I did.
Okay.
I ruled it out.
So what did you want instead then?
Actually, I put down marine biology in Galway was my top one. I always loved those David Attenborough shows. And to be honest, I had no idea what I wanted to do. Second to that was arts. But when I was about 16, I got a good opportunity to play over in the States. So I knew that if I sat the SATs in addition to my leaving cert,
right,
I could go over and study over there in the States. So I got that opportunity as well. But to be honest, in terms of the Irish university courses, I genuinely didn't really know what I wanted to do after that, because I felt, well, what I want to do is ruled out.
And it's a very familiar feeling, because we are rather young trying to make life decisions, I suppose, when you're doing the Leaving Cert. Can you remember what your Leaving Cert pressure felt like?
Yeah, it was quite substantial. Now, I was lucky enough that what I needed to get into to college in the States was my SATs. I needed a good score, so that was that pressure. And then I needed a good score in English. They wanted to take that and maths. That's just how the kind of system worked at the time. But the pressure to still perform was astronomical. And then, of course, at that age, you're kind of comparing yourself to your friends and wondering, well, if this doesn't work out, what do I have? So you're very worried about it. It's huge. It's, to be honest, I think it's too much pressure for somebody of that age, you know, 17, 18 years of age. But
the entire nation nods with you in agreement right now, I'm telling you now. Sinead.
Yeah.
So Sinead, tell me about the sports scholarship angle on for your entry. So you played sports and an opportunity came up. So you took your SATs. So you probably gave yourself a little more pressure.
Yeah, I suppose I did in that sense. So I did a camp when I was about 16 over in the States, and so that the coach could kind of have a look at me and I could get enough exposure, because at the time I hadn't played any international sport. I was just playing schools hockey. So once she got a look at me and said, you know, there'd be a spot here for you on this team, I knew that's what I wanted to do. Now, I was playing hockey and Gaelic at the time. So with the Leaving Cert coming up and then with that opportunity to play abroad, I decided to only focus on the hockey, which gave me time to also study for the SATs and the Leaving Cert.
So in a way, the sports scholarship is your first fork in the road, which kind of distracts you now. Off you go to America. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So it seems like the dream, no?
Yeah, it seems like the dream, yeah. And to be honest, it still is the best decision I ever made in my life. Like I know, like you've said before, it took me a while to get to where I want to be as a doctor, but I wouldn't change that for the world. And I think actually what the US system has in place is better than what the Irish system has in place, is where you apply to the university, you go in, they recognise that you do not know as an 18-year-old what you want to do. So some people, sure, I still don't really know what I want to do in medicine, you know.
Yeah.
So you go in and you take a load of different classes and courses for 2 years, and then you specialise for 2 years. And it gives you 2 years to kind of look around and do different classes and then realise, you know what, I thought I wanted to do this, but I don't, because I've taken a few classes in it. I actually enjoy this. I didn't realise I'd enjoy that, so I'm going to do that. I'm going to major in that. That's how they do it. I think that's actually a smart way of doing it.
So it gives you time to breathe and consider and think about what you want to do. And that's what that sports scholarship gave you, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But it gave you something else, didn't it? Because you found out something else about yourself.
Yeah, I suppose when I was over there, I think it was the end of my first year, early second year in college, I was diagnosed with ADHD and dyslexia. So a bit of a 1-2 punch. And,
wow.
You know, I struggled with that in secondary school, to be honest. And it wasn't until maybe my second or third year in college that I actually got a grip on it. And my academics vastly improved then once I got a hold of it.
And what does that difference that you have bring to medicine from your point of view?
I suppose with medicine, yes, of course, it's academically demanding. But you need to be able to converse with people. You need to be able to visualise things. You know, you have to be a well-rounded person. You can't just be somebody who's straight up academic. You know, those days are kind of gone in all fields of life. I like whether it's medicine or not, those days are gone. So for me, it's the ability to know how I learn, internalise that information, how I learn, and be able to communicate with patients, with staff members, with teammates, with that information that I have. So that's really important.
That's Dr. Sinead Loughran talking to Brendan Courtney on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show about her experience of going from mediocre school performance to medicine. The so-called Latte Levy on disposable coffee cups aims to curb the 500,000 cups sent to landfill or incineration every single day in this country. Lobby group Retail Excellence Ireland has said the levy doesn't make sense. And this morning, Claire Byrne spoke to 3FE Coffee's Colin Harmon and Green Party councillor Donna Cooney.
200 million coffee cups going to landfill or incineration every year. That is absolute madness when there's no need for it, you know. And we've seen before with the plastic bag levy that the success of that, it's been 20 years since that came in. And I think there was, people were worried about that. You know, I don't think people reduced their intake of shopping. You know, they just got used to bringing their bags with them. And there are reusable bags that you can purchase in the shops. And the same thing will happen with the coffee cups. And I suppose it's just a matter, it's a way to bring about that thought process that people remember to bring their keep cups with them. And if they don't, for a time being, for a while, I mean, I suppose, you know, when the process changes over, there will be funds that come in. It'll be ring fenced as an environmental fund, which will go to projects that work with reducing waste and environmental projects.
Well, Colin, I want to bring Colin in, Donna, because as Donna describes it there, Colin, we will all get used to this, like we got used to bringing our plastic bags with us. Do you agree?
I'd like to think so, but like I think it's a disproportionate step that the government are taking that will ultimately be very detrimental to a lot of coffee businesses across the country. I think anybody that visits coffee shops on a regular basis will know that coffee shops have been involved in sustainability problems and have probably been the point where people have been introduced to sustainability for many years now. We first sold the Keep Cup in 2009. And what I would say is that this is already being policed. The vast majority of coffee shops in the country are already giving discounts to people for bringing their own cups. The amount of reusable cups that we were using in our cafes has been growing year on year on year. And this will do three things. It's telling people that coffee cups are a disproportionate problem in sustainability. They're only a small aspect of what is the problem. The second thing is that it's generating a tax income for the government. And the third thing is it's depleting the revenue that the coffee shop can take. So coffee shops will be worse off for this. The government will get a tax stream. And people are being kind of hoodwinked into believing that coffee cups are the big problem here, when things like, you know, transport, agriculture are much, much bigger problems in this country.
Okay, what do you say to that, Donna, that coffee cups and coffee shop owners are being disproportionately targeted with this measure?
No, I mean, this isn't a tax or a revenue raising measure. I mean, hopefully when the effect behavioural change happens, there won't be any revenue coming from it. It'll disappear within a short space of time. But, you know, like in the time, it'll be ring fenced for environmental projects. It's not something that it'll be used as revenue for the government in any way whatsoever. And obviously, you know, it hasn't worked because, you know, entirely. I mean, I know coffee shops have, you know, you can get a reduction in a lot of them when you bring your keep cup. You can buy keep cups there. But it just hasn't been enough to bring down the number, you know, of the, in fact, it's increased because during COVID, more people are out and about walking, enjoying nature, which is great. And people will be out now on their lunch break. And, you know, I mean, I know myself when I go out and others that go out and do their tidy towns on a weekly basis or, you know, go out and do their cleanups like, you know, Bull Island Action Group, they've been looking for this for a long time. And like the plastic bag tax, that was looked for from environmental groups. And it's something we committed to as a Green Party. I put a motion in Dublin City Council about the plastic bag tax, and then it was brought in by the government. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this
But do you take Colin's point? Look at agriculture, look at aviation. Why is this one measure being targeted at coffee shop owners is going to, he says, affect them disproportionately when there are other things that can be done that might have a bigger impact?
No, there's a range of measures, and you know that this is a measure that can be brought in quickly and simply because and other measures are
coming in because it's easy. It's easy to do it.
Well, it's a quick fix. Yeah, you bring the quick fixes in. You know, it's you know.
Colin, quick fix.
I don't get what you mean when you say it won't be seen as tax revenue. It is. It's a tax. The government will bring it in. They'll spend it on projects.
It's ring fence for environmental funds to go to ENGOs and people that come up with innovative ways.
It's tax revenue if it's not tax. They're collecting a tax. They're taking it into government. It's tax revenue. That doesn't make any sense. I don't have the numbers for Ireland. And in the UK, coffee cups represent less than 0.1% of total waste. And it's probably very similar in Ireland. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be doing something. We absolutely should be doing. But it's disproportionate. People have been told that coffee cups are the problem. They're just a very visible thing that's there. And I agree with you that people stopped using it in COVID, but that was for very clear reasons. We couldn't be taking in reusable cups and handling them during COVID because we'd be infecting people. So it's coming back now. It's rising. We're already doing this. Coffee shops are very responsible. But, like, I look at the waste I generate every week with my weekly shop. It's crazy. Or if I go to a fast food restaurant to get a Happy Meal for the kids, like, the waste involved in that is massive. Like, a packet of ham, it's massive. And all of these things should be looked at, not just coffee cups. But coffee cups have become, and coffee shops have become a lightning bolt or a lightning rod even for kind of political gesturing. That's all that this is, really. It's that people say, oh, well, the coffee cups are the problem. And people are convinced that it is. But it's a very small problem. And the other thing is that people have their own ability to change that. If they're outraged by the amount of coffee cups, bring your reusable cups. We're on board. We want to do this with you. We've been doing it for 10 years. So bring them. We all want to use them.
And do you think, Colin,
coffee shops are going to be punished for this. It's going to cost a lot of money for coffee shops when costs are going up anyway.
And Colin, do you think this latte levy will mean that people will think twice about buying a coffee from you?
Oh, absolutely. And coffee shops will lose customers over this.
Colin Harmon from 3FE Coffee talking to Claire Byrne this morning, along with the Green Party's Donna Cooney, about the so-called latte levy that will add 20 cents to a disposable coffee cup. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And there'll be another episode of Playback Daily at the same time tomorrow. Until the next time, from me, thank you for listening and good luck.